Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. You know, art is all around us, and you can find it in the most unexpected of places. There's the art of Damascus steel, the art of a subway exit, the art of theme and variation. And guess what? We'll cover all those and more for you today on the show. First up, Sika curator Cora Fisher and New York-based artist Neil Goldberg open our eyes to all kinds of intimate artistic opportunities in Neil's multimedia anthology. Did you know that Triad is home to one of the finest trumpet players in the country? Yep, her name is Anita Serba, and I'm not just blowing hot air. She's here with trumpet and Carnival of Venice in hand to show you. I'll give you a hint how she does it. Practice, practice, practice. That's the same recipe for beautiful Damascus steel knife blade making, and we'll chat with a devoted blacksmith whose journey from auto repair to the art of the blade is pretty inspiring stuff. John Hagee feels like a fire god, and as well he should, next after this news. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. You know, sometimes it takes just a heightened awareness to recognize art or artistic moments that are going on all around us, oftentimes in places you might not expect. When we're open to artistic possibilities, the way the wind from a passing train sets someone's hair in motion, or the look of breath on a mirror might become moments to really savor. Artist Neil Goldberg has been appreciating those moments and creating his own for years. Neil's video, photo, and mixed media work has been exhibited at venues throughout Europe and across the country, including the Museum of Modern Art's permanent collection in New York. In 2013, his video, Surfacing, appeared simultaneously on multiple digital signs in Times Square in New York City. In it, dozens of people are filmed as they emerge from the New York City subway system. You can see Surfacing and much more at the Southeastern Center for Contemporary Art's Neil Goldberg Anthology in Winston-Salem. The exhibit explores three aspects of Neil's art, focusing on the fleeting, overlooked, and personal aspects of daily experience using video, photography, and objects of the last 15 years. Neil recently walked me through the exhibition along with Sika curator Cora Fisher.
The layout is actually kind of thought of as a compendium, which is another way of thinking about an anthology. It's a collection of works. And we've collected works by Neil Goldberg that span the last 20 years and kind of are loosely gathered under three facets of his work: observation, autobiography, and his studio practice.
Before we dive in, Neil, when you're looking at the span of work, and we're looking at two decades of work, trepidation, fears, learning, what I guess the first thing that comes to mind with that span of time and looking at it in retrospect?
It's one of those things where you disconnect from it, I find, in a certain very useful way. So putting this work together, actually, I can almost have this helpfully dissociated relationship to it where it's like, oh, this is an interesting show. I might put this over there if it were mine. It's not quite as dissociated as that. And I think generally the work speaks to itself, or the different pieces speak to each other in a way that that supports the work in my memory. I feel great seeing it like this.
All right, heading down the stairs here.
So what you're looking at right in front of you, which is a kind of monumental projection, is a piece called Surfacing. And I think it actually captures pretty well Neil's balancing act between really delicate, kind of spare, specific moments that he's looking at, taken from everyday life, and the monumentality that results in the projection that follows. And in Surfacing, Neil has placed a camera across the street from a subway exit in New York City, and the camera is just training these people who are emerging from underground, and they're actually in this very specific moment where they're trying to get their bearings. They're kind of looking every which way, and there's a lot of kind of feeling and pathos bound up in that moment of it's a kind of micro drama happening on a large scale.
Neil, I wanted to ask you, because I was looking at little mini images on my computer screen before I got here, this very same thing. And in Kennedy's review, he brings up the word vulnerability as referencing these faces, which I was immediately drawn to. And I'm wondering, if I'm playing devil's advocate, could that be perceived as am I projecting that? Or I mean, have you looked at it from so many angles that you could see it as in a different way?
Yeah, I do think that there's a vulnerability there. And for me, that's not necessarily a negative thing. If you're thinking about the perspective of how does it feel to be videotaped, the vulnerability of being videotaped in public without knowing about it, for me, I feel very comfortable with that, in that I look at each of these people as stand-ins. We are all each of them. So it's not like I'm calling some individual person out and being like, look at this freak. It's rather look at us. But I do think that this is a very vulnerable moment, and it's happening in public. And it's a very private moment that's happening in public. I love that combination of private and public.
Looking at it in this context, I mean, it's so perfect. And looking at it now, we've seen now close to 15 images. It's almost as if they are wonderful actors and actresses, but this is the real moment.
Yes, and that's the paradox of it. They are perfectly acting this moment, but they're living it. And I can't remember what the scientific principle is, if the act of observation changes the experiment. In this case, I would say these pieces are utterly contingent on people not being self-conscious. And I just think it's a real gift to see people presenting this type of authentic, if I can use that word, vulnerable moment, and for all of us to share it.
I mean, there's also a gift to be able to recognize these moments. I would call it an artistic moment. Is that something that you've developed over years and years? Have you had it since a little boy?
I think I've always been very interested in the everyday. You know, if we want to get into deep psychological background, I grew up when I was quite young with an older brother who was dying of cystic fibrosis. And I remember just the very act of his being alive was effortful and wasn't taken for granted. So I think that kind of helped shape my focus on just the everyday. But then I remember I grew up in Long Island, and we would come into the city. So Long Island is a half hour out of the city. And I remember when we'd start to see apartment buildings, and I think it's a pretty common feeling, looking at just all those rows of windows and thinking about like all the lives that are happening behind them.
What strikes you most looking at these images, Cora?
Well, one of the things that I've talked about with Neil and that I think is really important for understanding the medium of video is what is projection? What does that mean? And psychologically, projection is, you know, being able to kind of lay yourself out, kind of put yourself in a situation or onto an object even that is, you know, external to you, but with all of the feeling that you would have in relationship to yourself. And I think what we see in these videos is that, and what we see in all of Neil's work, is that it creates a space in which we can be really different together. We can also project ourselves into the image if we want to be a part of that story, that we can experience identification and a sense of human connection, and that we're also really thinking about attentiveness towards this very small moment that's otherwise overlooked. And I think especially in our time when people are, their attention is so frayed, it's really special to have these ruminations and these moments where we can really just spend time in the act of this framed moment of looking.
I'm glad you use the word connection, Cora, because I'm seeing, and I've been standing here now for about 5 minutes. I don't think I've seen any repetition. If this is on a loop, I've seen so many different faces, so different, so many different ages, genders, races, and yet the look, the way they're approaching this moment, there's a commonality there that, I mean, I just find really comforting. Was that in your mind at all?
Very much so, and that kind of relationship of continuity with some idiosyncrasy. But when I watched this piece, I experienced it the same way that as one would kind of like the rhythm track of a musical piece, with the different faces sort of, there's a beat to the edit, and then there's the faces kind of form this type of melody. I think that's a little facile, but I am very interested in this moment when the individuality of the subject sort of drops away, but is still present. Like there's a tension between that, between this connection between everyone there and their specific idiosyncrasies.
I could stay in here and look at this for hours. I mean, I'm being perfectly honest with you. It's so fascinating for me. But I have to ask, if one of these people were to see their image and call you up and be angry, how did you get them? What repercussions could there be? Have you thought that through? Has that ever come up before, where someone said, "I don't want my face in your art"?
No one has come up having seen their themselves in my art and said, please remove me. And if they did, I would absolutely do that. Once one of my pieces that's not in here was shown in the New York Times, and someone who saw it there and came to the show and wrote me a nice note. But I think from a legal standpoint, I can't remember the term, but there is, you relinquish your expectation of privacy in public. And so as long as one is not using this work to sell something else, there are very specific laws around it. It's technically legal now. That being said, if anyone were to object, and it hasn't happened, but I could imagine it happening, I would, of course, honor their request. But my hope would be that people would recognize my intention in this, which is, again, a type of them functioning as a mirror, and it comes from a place of, I would say, respect.
So I think what I'd love to do is walk over around to this other part of the gallery where we're showing a piece that's debuting here at SICA. It's called 10 and a Half Years of To-Dos. And it's a really interesting, again, embodied experience of how we inhabit our daily lives. So what Neil has done in this space is he's enlisted 5 young men to sit in a tree and read 10 and a half years of his to-do lists. Just here right above you is a hanging speaker that is actually one of these performers' recitations of this list.
This is fantastic. I'm going to lift the microphone up so you all can hear this fellow on the far left, I think, reading one of Neil's to-do lists.
Serial numbers. Zen system for writing to Archie Perlmutter, artistic director, Philadelphia Jewish Film Festival.
And just for the heck of it, I'm going to move over to another reader.
Beth Koblinger for Coffee. Respond to Georgia about being at half 7:31. Nate Ree, Cirque du Soleil.
Talk about an immersive experience. I mean, that's an overused term, but I mean, I feel like I'm on one of the branches here. It's a fascinating concept. When did this concept come to you, Neil? And in what form did it take?
Well, the idea came to me actually quite a while ago. I was at the McDowell Colony, which is an environment where you're given an art studio to do what you will. But at a particular moment, I was just really focused on some logistical details. And outside my window, the guys who work, you know, maintain the grounds came by in a truck with their shirts off. And I just sort of, here I was thinking about the things I needed to do. And I had the idea, what would it be like to have them reading this list I was contending with up in a tree. So that's where it came from. But I've just always been very attached and fascinated by this to-do list I've kept. There are 10,000 items that they're reciting here, more than 10,000. And for me, it's about a type of longing and youth and I guess a contrast between these little tasks that comprise our day and these more kind of like aspirational, dreamy visions one has of one's life.
This seems like a way of letting go in a sense. I mean, I saw a couple of them dropping pages accidentally too, which I love the image of that.
Yeah, as they finish a page, they just let it drop from the tree to the ground. I think you're right. What do you, that's such a great way of framing it. In this project, it's not the act of doing the specific to-do that is meaningful, but the to-dos themselves become kind of their own type of art. And that is a way of letting them go and letting them have their own life apart from how they're realized or not.
I'm getting a little Jungle Book.
For sure. I think also what's really amazing is that when life is comprised, or the loftier aspect of life is comprised in a series of very regimented and organized lists of tasks, like a to-do list, that there's a kind of flattening out that happens where it's like, what's important? I don't know. Is getting coffee at the store less important than writing a symphony or meeting with a museum director or having a radio interview? There's something about the equality of these actions that are taken or not taken, but that are kind of coalesced into this musical score for this chorus of performers that I think is really beautiful. And it's also a big inspiration for the show, I think, being understood as an anthology, because so many of the works in this exhibition really think about what are the units of life or of lived experience, and how do those get translated in all of these different ways that tell stories, small stories, but also very big stories?
Hmm. Music and commonality coming back in a different guise here completely, but there's just something so soothing about the image. First off, that's a beautiful tree. Where did you find that?
It took a lot of work. And, you know, if talk about bucket lists, if my job in life involved tree scouting, I think I'd be pretty happy. But this is a gorgeous magnolia in the Rutgers Botanic Gardens across the river in New Jersey. It's interesting with a lot of these projects, the conversations you have with people, like, you know, do you know of a, you end up speaking to like someone who worked at one botanic garden was like, oh, you know, you should talk to so-and-so. And that person was like, oh yeah, there's a magnolia at Rutgers Gardens. So
tree scouting. And this was filmed over how many hours?
Probably 12 painful hours. I mean, we're seeing a 49-minute take of it, but just the work of shooting it was deeply challenging, but it compresses 10 and a half years into 49 minutes.
Again, I could just spend a half hour or two right here, but alas, we must move on. We must. We're on the corner. Okay.
So speaking again to this idea of the public and the private being kind of two sides of a coin, we here are in an area of the exhibition that is focused more on direct personal experience, a body of work in which Neil has worked very closely with his own family members and in particular with his parents. And we sense a kind of story unfolding in the space that's happening over time, much like the to-do lists distort our sense of time. If we walk over here, we'll see the earliest piece in this suite of works, which is a video work called My Parents Read Dreams I've Had About Them. And if you have a look at it, it's actually a pretty funny image. Mom is on the left, Dad is on the right, and Neil has asked them to, like the title says, quite literally, read the dreams that he's written down in which they are part of that dream. And so it's an interesting kind of psychic space that we're presented with, but it's also a really interesting interaction between son and parents, kind of co-producing an artwork.
There's a scene where Jerry has some sort of gash in his head, is bleeding, and is eating an apple. Takes a big bite out of the apple, then puts it on top of gash while he chews. The apple gets all bloody. He takes another bite. I laugh really hard, but I'm not sure if I actually find it funny or just want to find it funny.
Was this a forced interactive, or was she a willing participant?
My parents had a kind of, I would describe their participation as a benefit of the doubt. Like, I don't get it, but you're asking me to do it. I don't know if they actually knew that they could say no, you know, and that maybe says a lot about our relationship. But they didn't quite get what I was going for, but gave benefit of the doubt. And my mom does look very stoic. You'll see if you stay to the end, she actually starts laughing. And what's reading as stoicism is her trying to hold back a well-deserved, uncomfortable laugh, you know, about the material she's being asked to read.
How long were they married?
I think 46 years.
In this film, they're both in their
mid to late 70s at that point.
The delivery is so perfect for the dream. Did this come off the way you had envisioned?
Well, like with so many works, you don't know how it's going to come off, and that's part of what motivates the interest in doing it. So I really didn't know what it was going to look like and what the experience was going to be like. So it was surprising.
Talk about making yourself vulnerable. I mean, I think there's a real generosity here with your willingness to kind of share your unconscious with the general public. So again, you know, this interplay between it's you and it's me equally, I feel that very much in this piece. And, you know, we all hopefully have parents in some way, shape, or form. And so there's a lot of identification that I think happens here. We see their discomfort, but they're also kind of, you know, your collaborators, your co-conspirators. So I think that that's very comforting.
Southeastern Center for Contemporary Art curator Cora Fisher, and she was joined by artist and Yale School of Art critic Neil Goldberg. Neil Goldberg Anthology will remain on display at CECA through October 5th, and you'll find links to images and more at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. This CECA exhibit, like just about all CECA exhibits, is free and open to the public. I'm David Ford, and we're going to take a short break before returning with the art of the trumpet and everything you ever wanted to know about Damascus steel blades, but were afraid to ask, next when Triad Arts Weekend continues. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Did you know that one of our nation's oldest community bands performs all year long right here in the Triad? It's true. The Salem Band, formed back in 1771, performs outdoor concerts in the beautiful shaded confines of Salem Square practically year-round. They're led by music director and Winston-Salem Symphony bass clarinetist Eileen Young. Last week, Eileen and the band were joined by outstanding guest soloist Winston-Salem and Greensboro Symphony principal trumpeter Anita Serba. Anita performed Leroy Anderson's Trumpeter's Lullaby, and also on the program was the challenging variations on the folk tune Carnival of Venice. Anita dropped by to talk trumpet. What are a few things, being a trumpet player in an orchestra, things that come up that might surprise a listener with no familiarity with that position, that role in an orchestra?
Well, the brass section sits in the back of the auditorium. And myself as a principal trumpet player, I have to lead the other sections of the group. So the horns, the trombones, tuba, and the rest of the trumpet section.
They look to you.
They look to me. Now, I tune from the tuba, from the lowest instrument of the brass section. We listen to that. But as far as leadership and playing solos and the character of the sound, people look to me as a principal player for that kind of thing.
So much like in the string section, they look to the concertmaster mm-hmm. to get the style, the attack, the kind of overall mm-hmm. approach to the music.
Yep.
Interesting.
That's it.
Is it fun? Is it overwhelming? What? That's a big responsibility.
It is a big responsibility. there's a lot of solos playing principal trumpet in an orchestra. And it's very demanding and can be very stressful. You know, sometimes I wonder if I shouldn't be more egotistical to play the part because I'm very much an introvert, even though I don't sound like that sometimes. It takes a lot of stress to play that principal spot. People are always looking for you, you know, to lead the group. And it's just, it can be overwhelming at times.
Well, you had some pretty good pedigree to look up to, I guess, gather some focus and an approach to that. And I'm talking about the former trumpeter with the Cleveland Orchestra and Bernard Edelstein. In your years of study with him for your master's there at Cleveland, any good George Zell stories to go along with that?
Lots of George Zell stories. But the main thing that happened to me when I first got there, I had taken, when I was at Brevard Music Center for the summer, F1979, I was very fortunate to have some friends of mine who went to the Cleveland Institute of Music. And they said, you have to audition for the school. And I thought, I am not good enough to get in there. No, go ahead and audition. So I auditioned. I got in on the spot. And I got assigned to Edelstein to be my trumpet teacher. Well, it was a videotape, so they could see me as well as hear me. And, of course, I was 100 pounds less than I am now. But my first lesson with Edelstein was scary because I'd heard all these horrible stories about this man, you know, because, you know, he was in the big orchestra. So what happened was I went into my lesson. I sat behind the music stand in my seat, and I was scared to death. And he walks in the door. And the first thing he says to me, he hovers over top of the music stand and says, young lady, someone has to tell you this. And I was like, oh, my gosh, what is he going to say? He said, you have 3 strikes against you right now. And I looked up and I was almost in tears, but I was like, oh my God, what is he going to say? Next, he said, number 1 is you're a woman. Number 2 is you play a brass instrument. And number 3, you're overweight. And I am not kidding you. I am not a very outspoken person, especially at that time. And I don't know where the courage came from, but I mustered up some courage and I said, I can only do something about one of those things. And I lost like 35 pounds for that man, you know, in like a 4-month period. But it was stressful. And just to know that was what the criteria of being a female trumpet player, at least I see that as a female trumpet player. You know, the qualifications was scary.
Yeah.
But I really practiced a lot. And, of course, my second year there, I went up to Cleveland Orchestra in Carnegie Hall, and he asked me to play first trumpet off stage on the Verdi Requiem. So I was very excited. But he did tell me lots of stories about George Zell. And in the basement, he had, you know, of his house, he had taken students, and they had like trumpet quartets, trumpet ensemble meetings and lessons down in Bernard Edelstein's basement, and he would tell all these horrific stories about George Zell. But yeah, at the same time, he totally loved the man and respected him.
Yeah, I found that there's a certain heft when you're in a lesson situation with someone who you know has lived through, in his case, 28 years, well, overlapped with George Zell for several years.
Well, he was there as principal trumpet for 35 years.
35 years total, yeah. And Mazel came in after George Zell.
Yes.
So he took, we're talking inside ball here, but back in the 50s and 60s, the conductor pretty much could on the spot just single somebody out and say, you're out of here.
He did that to the principal horn player when I was in the school there. And he, well, at least what the story I had heard was that when I was at the school, he took the principal, I can't remember the guy's name, but the guy who was studying at the School of the Arts played extra with the Cleveland Orchestra. And the thing I heard was that the principal horn player made a mistake, and George Zell told him to go back and do it again. He missed it again. He said, you're out of here. He wanted the third horn player to step up into the principal position, and he was there the entire time I was at the school.
Wow.
Isn't that horrible? I mean, that's scary.
Yeah.
So it was that kind of tension. Growing up as a female trumpet player, I had to be better than the guys, you know, and practiced a lot there.
Well, that's why I wanted to bring that up, to put it in perspective. And then we're talking about the 70s, 80s. This was before, I mean, there are more women in brass sections around the country, around the world today, but still, comparatively speaking, relatively few.
And my first band director was a woman trumpet player.
How
she inspired
that?
Me to play. I knew in fifth grade that if she could play it, I could do it.
All right. And of course, I went to school. Gail Williams was the big French hornist in the Chicago Symphony, revered brass player. Great. Did you study with Alan at UNCSA?
I did, Alan Dean.
Okay. Quite a career in chamber music with Summit Brass and commercial music too.
Calliope. Yeah.
What was your takeaway from your studies with Alan?
Alan came in my trumpet lessons he always had his lunch. He would always eat in my lessons. And I just thought it was the funniest thing. He would sit there and eat while he had his legs crossed, very relaxed. And I would play all these Vannevar Bush technical studies by Charlier, Vannevar Bush, and all these things. And he'd say, oh, that was lovely. And it was like, you know, chomp, chomp, chomp on his apple. It was great. I mean, I just loved him. He was there for about 2.5 years. And, of course, Ray Mace was there after that.
Right.
And he had been straight out of New York. One of the proteges in New York.
You had some great, I mean, New Yorker perspectives.
Absolutely.
in your trumpet playing. I mean, in terms of the technique, or what were a couple of takeaways from you from that experience?
Interesting enough, because when I did study with Alan Dean and Ray Mace, they were more of a brass quintet sound, very lyrical, very singing, legato kind of sound. And I had been put into the School of the Arts Orchestra when I was very young, 11th, 12th grade, so I really didn't know orchestral playing at all. But when I got to Cleveland, it was my first real experience on how to play loud. And Mr. Edelstein told me, he said, you are not in North Carolina anymore. You need to play like the big guys do. And so he held me up against the wall. He put me up against the wall and put his fist in my stomach and said, blow my fist out. Well, I didn't know what he was talking about because I thought I would have been playing loud. And he said, no, you need to play really, really loud. And so I did. And he said, now that's what I want to hear. From now on, every lesson, I want you to play all your etudes in a loud fashion. So it developed my airstream to play loud and orchestrally. So there's a huge difference between what Ray Mason and Alan Dean taught me and then the big, huge jump to Edelstein.
That's right, because Ray was the American brass.
Yeah, right.
American, exactly. Two of the great brass ensembles in the world, mm-hmm. But the chamber music perspective, interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This whole notion of pushing against your stomach while you're playing, I mean, he's developing diaphragmatic breathing, mm-hmm. right?
Exactly, and I have my students do that at my house when I teach them. People think that they know how to breathe and they just breathe from the chest cavity. But when you actually can get a student or anybody really that you're talking to breathe correctly, you have to bring everything like down from your gut and just and then blow it out. And then it's amazing the quality of sound that you can get from that.
Yeah.
Now you can control that, of course. We don't go and then
for two bars of music.
Right.
Yeah. And just again, for the non-musician, it's amazing what control that gives you, what you can do with the sound. Describe how that takes place. When you get that good comfy breath, like you just took a big yawn, what does it do for you?
Well, you have to control it. I had a student yesterday who did not know how to do that, and his face turned red for about 3 minutes. And I said, it's okay, it's going to go away. But he said, but I'm using my air right. And I said, that's right, but now you need to learn to control it. Now, everybody that goes to the concerts, they seem to tell me, your face always turns red. Well, you know, I'm not a small person either. But when I do get red-faced, I still have more to offer. I still have more air there. I'm not going to explode or anything. But there is a big challenge in trying to control your air.
Oh, that's just some beautiful playing right there. Yeah. Oh, it's so beautiful. And is playing soft easier, harder, the same? Talk about the different challenges in playing, you know, really forte and playing pianissimo or piano on the trumpet.
Actually, to me, it's harder to play softer because you use a lot more air.
More air.
Yeah, the louder you play, the faster the air is. But the more you really have to concentrate on playing the sound soft by almost like not grunting, so to speak, but like a really, you have to have really solid abs. I keep telling people I have a lot of good abs underneath all this.
you get some good resistance there.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're really...
It's easier for me to play loud.
Interesting. Is this a piece that and every trumpeter has to play, or is it... Where does this one fall in the can? I'm talking about the carnival here.
Yeah, the Carnival of Venice has so many different variations now. Al Vizzuti has his arrangement. Dale Steggers has one. Arbenz has his. You know, Herbert L. Clark. And, of course, Wynton Marsalis, you know, has made it well known the way he plays it.
When you say different versions, what are we talking about?
There's actually different variations on that. I mean, the Al Vizzuti version, I can't even play. I can't even play the first line. Because, first of all, it goes up to, like, notes that I don't even know what the names of them are. I don't play screech trumpet, so I couldn't tell you.
That's
there are
right.
players in town that could probably play that, but not me.
For non-musicians, when you say screech trumpet, we're talking about the Maynard Fergusons out there. That's
absolutely
the way up in the stratosphere players.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And Al Vizzuti can hit those. And he wrote his own variations for that piece.
Okay, so he got the same theme, but they're writing their own variations.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good entree into this whole concept, Anita, of theme and variations, because that's what this piece is. What are we talking about?
Okay, so the theme, I'm going to play the theme first, and then play a little bit of the first variation. And so this is the theme, which carries all the way through the whole piece. And then the little variation on that.
And that was, believe it or not, out there listening, the very simple of all the variations. Did they become just increasingly more technically challenging?
Absolutely. That one, you know, just a little bit of a 6/8 feel to it, which the whole piece is, but it's bum, 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 bum. A lot of rest in between there. A little bit of a couple of 16th notes to do the variation. The next one has like a slurred part of variation, has a little bit of slurred triplets. Not the tongue triplets yet, but it has. So this is what this one sounds like. So that's that variation. The next one is even more ridiculous because it goes from one end of the instrument to the next, or at least in an octave.
Gosh.
I'm just hoping my lips and gums are going to be, and fingers are going to be on time.
Oh, my goodness. And believe it or not, it just goes on and on from there. If maybe we could take one of the later variations with articulation and do it in super slow-mo for
gotcha.
Our listeners. Because I'm curious to know, Anita, how you even begin to prepare a piece like this. And if you could kind of break down what goes on in your mind practicing this so that it becomes, you know, you get that good muscle memory going in concert.
Well, that's exactly what I do, is I do it slowly. And so variation 4, it has a mixture of triplets.
And should say for listeners that by triplet, Anita's talking about 3 notes per beat, and it would sound like dot, 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 dot. Those are triplets.
So when I play it the way I should play it, and then 2 more variations before the very, very final one. The variation 6 is more of a more legato, relaxed feel, and a little bit more rubato. it goes into double tonguing, which I'll do slowly first, which is taka 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 taka. But there's slur two, tongue two, slur two, tongue two. So very slowly. So at speed.
There you go.
Now, the very last one, the last variation, is very difficult. And it is in 32nd notes where the melody comes bum, 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 bum. But see if you can hear that within the 32nd notes. I'll do it slow.
Oh, this is going to be super slow-mo, and then we'll do it up to speed. Okay, here we go. So, Anita, you're putting an accent on those thematic notes, aren't
right.
you? All right.
Right.
Great. Well, this is here we are at 100 miles an hour. Ready to go.
Okay, now super fast.
Oh, and it's
not just two lines worth. It's about 17 lines of that.
Looking at this music of all black 32nd notes, it's coming at you for almost two entire pages of that. And I hope they buy you some ice cream afterwards. That's just
I'll just be nice and happy to be sitting out in the audience.
There you go. Winston-Salem and Greensboro Symphony principal trumpeter Anita Serba. Last week, she joined the Salem Band and Salem Band director Eileen Young in a performance of Carnival of Venice. The performance, like most Salem Band concerts, took place in beautiful Salem Square. The outdoor concerts are free and open to the public, and you'll find links to the complete performance schedule at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and when we return from this short intermission, craftsman John Hagee will join me to talk shop. This time, our subject will be the art of the blade, specifically the Damascus steel blade. And believe me, there's lots to learn and lots to like just about 60 seconds from now on Triad Arts Weekend. Stay with us. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. They were our ancestors' first tools, one of the oldest forms of art, among the first family heirlooms, and essential for early man's survival. Knives. On September 13th and 14th, some of the finest old world craftsmen from the U.S. and Canada will gather with their handmade knives at the Southeastern Custom Knife Show held in Winston-Salem. Incredible examples of blacksmithing skill acquired over decades of intensive training will be on display and for sale at the Benton Convention Center downtown. My next guest is North Carolina Knife Makers Guild and American Blacksmiths Society member John Hagee. After years as a successful auto mechanic, John caught the Damascus steel blade bug. He left the auto world behind and never looked back. He got the bug courtesy of North Carolina Knife Guild member and show founder Tommy McNabb.
Tommy was producing a show, the Southeastern Custom Knife Show at the time, and he gave me a pass to the show. And I went there and I saw the craft work of the knife makers who were displaying there, and I was just awestruck. I had no idea. You know, when you think of a knife, you think of a blade and a handle, and that's about how far it goes. But the art and the craft that went into these knives was just stunning. And engraving and scrimshaw and precious metal inlay and jewelry inlay and pattern welded steel, it was like nothing I'd ever seen. And I came out of the show and Tommy asked me what I thought, and I told him I thought I'd found the answer to my midlife crisis.
It seems like for you there's a whole lot there beyond just a knife.
Well, it occurred to me at some point that the embellishment and the decoration of a knife is really probably one of our oldest art forms, because the tools that anthropologists find that have these images carved in them and various other kinds of embellishment. They've come up with various reasons why these images might be carved into the knife, but I think mostly it just comes back to that these items were prized possessions that were handed down through generations, and the owners of them did everything they could to make them unique and attractive.
What aspects of the craft are you working toward now? Like, give me an example of something you're trying to hone, for lack of a better way of putting it.
Well, the Damascus steel is something I'm really working on right now.
What does that mean, Damascus steel?
It's a common name for what technically is called pattern welded steel. And it's something that emerged back in ancient times. Some of the first examples were found in Damascus. The early bladesmiths and the early blacksmiths were trying to achieve a knife blade or a sword blade that had sufficient hardness to maintain an edge, but sufficient toughness to be able to stand a lot of abuse. If they made the knife too hard, then it would be brittle. And if they made the knife too soft and tough, then it wouldn't hold an edge. Well, they knew that some steel was harder than other steel. They didn't know why. We know now that it's got everything to do with carbon content of the steel, but back then they didn't really know why some steel was harder than other steel, but they could control the hardness of a piece of steel by forge welding two different pieces of steel together. They would weld a hard piece of steel to a soft piece of steel, and then they would work it out and fold it and hammer it flat and fold it and hammer it flat, and they would repeat that operation until there were layers in the bar that were about a thousandth of an inch thick, and then they would make a blade out of it.
Wow.
And the blades were pretty well coveted in the area because they were the finest knife and sword blades available.
How many different layers then in a typical blade from that era?
Hundreds of layers in a blade that was about an eighth of an inch thick might have 300, 400, 500 layers in it.
That's mind-blowing.
Well, the smiths later found out that they could do different things to the steel that would manipulate the patterns in the layers, and then they would etch the steel, and the two different types of steel in there would react differently to the etchant, and a pattern would emerge on the blade. They would use these patterns as kind of a trademark. You could look at a blade, and by the pattern in the steel, you could tell what smith had made that blade.
Now, you brought in a blade with you today. Could you describe it for me?
That's about a 9-inch Bowie knife that I made out of Damascus steel. This is a 400-layer bar of Damascus steel that I twisted while it was hot until it looked like a corkscrew, and then hammered it out flat and made a knife out of it, and that's how I got those patterns.
And to look at the patterns, it's really beautiful. It's almost like a natural wood grain.
Yeah, that's what a lot of people compare it to. And there are some other patterns that have concentric bullseyes and kind of a topographical pattern. And all these patterns have different names. They're very popular. The people that have really been working with Damascus steel for a long time like to try and develop their own patterns the same way the ancient smiths did.
Hmm. What is the name of that pattern?
That's just a basic twist.
A basic twist.
Yeah, I'm still a little early in the craft.
Well, a little bit early, but you're working towards, I guess the title is a master smith. What's entailed in achieving that standard?
Well, the ABS, the American Bladesmith Society, started rating bladesmiths about 30 years ago, and they'll bestow the rating of journeyman smith on the first level smiths and the master smith on those who've gone through the journeyman level and achieved other things. They have a series of tests that you have to go through. One of them is a performance test where you have to forge a blade that can be that can cut a 1-inch rope that's hanging freely in one stroke. And then you have to chop 2 2x4s in half with it, and it still has to have a good enough edge on it to be able to shave. And then after you've completed that, to prove that you could make the blade tough as well, you have to put the blade in a vise and pull on it and bend it 90 degrees without it breaking. And that's the performance test. It's a destructive test. The knife is done
after
the test. But after you've passed the performance test, then you can submit five knives to the board for judging. And they look them over. They have seven judges, and they look your knives over. And if four out of seven thinks they're good enough, they judge them for fit, finish, and design. Then you get your journeyman rating, and it comes with a little stamp that you can put in your blades.
Wow, talk about a rigorous process. I've heard about some of the entry-level considerations for the Piedmont Craftsman just to exhibit there. It's pretty tough, but this is that on steroids. And I imagine Tommy's going to take a look at some of your blades before they get shipped off to the judges.
Tommy gets to critique most of my work. I spend a lot of time with Tommy, and he's taught me everything I can soak up.
Mm.
And matter of fact, he critiqued this blade this morning and told me I was going to have to take it back to the shop today and re-etch it.
Boy, isn't it great to have a mentor like that?
Yeah, he doesn't cut me a lot of slack.
Yeah, well, that's what you need. And then between now and that final examination period, what's in store for you?
Well, I'm not eligible to apply for Master Smith for 2 years since I just got my journeyman this year. But to do the Master Smith test, you have to do pretty much the same tests, except it has to be done with Damascus steel, including the performance knife. Uh-huh. Meanwhile, I'm trying to develop other aspects of the craft, working on my design, and I do some silver wire inlay and various kinds of metal embellishment on the handles. And anything that I see that fascinates me, I just go straight home and try it in the workshop.
What's the recent fascination? Are you talking about bone handles, or what kind of material do you gravitate toward for the handle?
I like natural materials. That would be bone and antler and wood. There are some woods that are really good for knife handles and some woods that are really bad. I like desert ironwood, which is a southwestern product that makes a really, really hard, durable wood that has beautiful figuring in it. I use synthetic materials sometimes when somebody orders a working knife that they're going to really be abusing. They're going to take it out in the woods and use it really hard, and it's going to get wet and be exposed to the elements. I'll use synthetic materials in those, but they're not as attractive to me.
What's something you've been experimenting with recently that fascinated you in terms of just, you mentioned inlay embellishment on the handles, for example?
The silver wire is really neat. That's something I learned from a fella in Alabama. Joe Kiesler is a real pro at that. And it's an art form that was common to the guys that made the Kentucky long rifles. Those big rifles that had the big maple stocks on them. Quite often they'd spend a lot of time embellishing the stocks of those rifles with engraved brass plates and silver wire inlay.
And silver wire inlay, you is it molten and you drip it into a pattern? How does it work?
No, I cut a notch in the wood and I hammer the wire into the wood and then I swell the wood shut with steam and the grain of the wood wraps back around the wire and holds it in.
I love stuff like this. That's just...
I do too.
What a science. Yeah, I can tell. Well, that kind of leads me to what we can find at the Southeastern Custom Knife Show, because I imagine the variety's got to be pretty staggering.
You'll be amazed.
Yeah. What can we expect to see there?
Well, you can expect to see knives made by some world-class knife makers, people who've been in the craft for decades and have really been working on it. They do Damascus steel, of course, several types, and they do a lot of engraving and inlay work, and the variety of design is really staggering. You know, when you think of knives, you, as I said, you start out thinking of a blade and a handle, and you don't go much beyond that. But when you see what can be done with these designs, it's really eye-opening.
From teeny knives to machetes, I mean, what's the gamut in terms of the shape and size of them?
There will be some guys there selling folding pocket knives. Tim Britton's a local maker that does a lot of folding knives. He lives out near Bethania. And there's going to be a guy on the front row, I believe, that's going to be selling samurai swords. So, yeah, we're going to run the whole length there. There'll be knives there probably in a price range from under $100 to thousands of dollars. So you can find whatever you're looking for, and you won't even know what you're looking for until you find it.
For the naysayer who says, well, why should I get my knife at this show? Why not just go to Bed Bath & Beyond? What are you going to find there? What sets this apart?
If you go to Bed Bath & Beyond or any other retailer, you're going to buy a knife that was mass-produced in a factory, probably in China. And yes, it will cost a great deal less, but it's got no heart and soul to it. This was a craft that was still going on around us, maybe in the North Carolina mountains, as late as the 1930s, 1940s. And so as an art form, it almost disappeared. And the ABS and other bladesmiths that were fooling around with it, they resurrected the art. They rediscovered a lot of secrets. And, well, now it's all over the place. Everybody's doing it, but... It could have gone away. It came that close.
North Carolina Knife Makers Guild and American Blacksmith Society member John Hagee. The 2014 Southeastern Custom Knife Show is Saturday, September 13th and Sunday the 14th at the Benton Convention Center in downtown Winston-Salem. You'll find links to more information at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. Well, that's all for today's program. Our technical producer is Eddie Garcia, our associate producer is Bethany Chafin, and our interns are Michaela Nance and Jorge Clifton. You'll find podcasts at WFDD.org. I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.